were Santorelli, soon to be an aide to Mitchell, GOP Chief House Counsel John Dean, Ehrlichman, and future Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, then a domestic policy advisor. Nixon himself sat in on the initial meeting. The first order of business was to figure out which crimes to target. Mitchell made clear in both meetings that the crimes that seemed to most worry the public, armed robbery and burglary, weren't the purview of the federal government. Moreover, there was no political benefit to tackling those crimes. Even if the administration's policies worked, local law enforcement would get most of the credit. They decided that the high-profile target for the new administration's promised anti-crime effort would be drug control. Drug use, they thought, was the common denominator among the groups: low-income blacks, the counterculture, and the anti-war movement, against whom Nixon had unified, ignored America. Because the drug trade crossed both state and international borders, there were also no federalism issues. So it was decided that the new Nixon administration would push for massive budget increases for agencies like BNDD and LEAA. They would ask for 1,000 new police officers for D.C., an idea that, oddly enough, came from Washington Post publisher Katherine Graham in a personal plea to Ehrlichman. And of course, they'd demand no-knock and preventive detention for federal drug agents, just as they would for police in Washington, D.C. The Nixonites mulled a number of other constitutionally dubious drug war proposals in addition to the preventive detention and no-knock proposals. They wanted to authorize the use of loose search warrants. These would have allowed police to apply for a warrant for contraband, then search multiple properties to find it. The idea came precipitously close to a writ of assistance, but without the restrictions on nighttime service and knock and announce. Combined with the no-knock provision, it would have essentially authorized police to kick down the doors of entire neighborhoods with a single warrant. Loose warrants didn't make the final crime bill, but the idea was really only about 10 years ahead of its time. Starting in the 1980s, police would conduct raids of entire city blocks, housing complexes, and neighborhoods. The Nixon administration also wanted to strip away attorney-client privilege, as well as the privilege afforded to conversations with priests and doctors, and to expand wiretapping authority. They even came up with an early precursor to California's eventual three strikes and you're out law. No one had any idea if these policies would work, but in a way it didn't matter. The strategy was as much about symbolism and making the right enemies as it was about effectiveness. There was much discussion over whether the policies sounded harsh enough or sounded too harsh. There was at least some discussion over whether they would actually work. But there was very little internal discussion about whether the policies were constitutional, whether they were susceptible to abuse, whether they would have unintended consequences, or what impact they might have on the communities they'd be enforced against. On July 14, 1969, Nixon gave his first major address to Congress to outline his anti-drug program. He declared drugs a national threat. He set the tone for a much more aggressive, confrontational federal drug fight. He described the inhumanity of drug pushers, laying groundwork for the sort of dehumanizing rhetoric that would be used for years to come to reduce drug users and drug dealers to an enemy to be destroyed. Society has few judgments too severe, few penalties too harsh for the men who make their livelihood in the narcotics traffic, he said. To that end, he proposed massive budget increases for BNDD and asked for money to hire scores of new federal narcotics officers. He called for the creation of special forces within the agency that will have the capacity to reeve quickly into any area in which intelligence indicates major criminal enterprises are engaged in the narcotics traffic. Borrowing more military terminology, he asked that Congress make funding for the units available soon so that they could fully deploy by 1971. Since Nixon had campaigned and staked his re-election hopes on reducing crime, and since crime policy and police procedures were primarily local issues, he had a strong interest in seeing that the states adopted his plan. That was one reason for expanding the LEAA. Local police agencies were likely to be more receptive when they got free stuff in exchange for their cooperation. He also came up with a piece of model legislation based on his federal bills, no-knock, preventive detention, wiretapping, and so on, that state legislatures could pass to show they were allies in the national fight. He told Congress that he had instructed his Justice Department to host a number of drug policy conferences across the country, where federal and local narcotics officers could exchange information and tactics. Nixon also addressed the demand side with a number of rehabilitation and treatment programs. The next year, the administration would even fund a methadone program in Washington, D.C., run by addiction specialist Robert DuPont. In a few areas, Nixon could move immediately, without waiting for money or authorization from Congress. One such area was border enforcement. On September 21, 1969, the Nixon administration launched Operation Intercept under the direction of G. Gordon Liddy. Every vehicle crossing into the United States was to be thoroughly searched by U.S. Customs agents. The agents were told to search each car for a minimum of 3 minutes, including trunks, glove compartments, bags, and underneath seats. For all practical purposes, the operation shut down the border. California trade to a crawl. It was an extreme, hostile policy, the sort normally implemented by countries in times of war. It proved so unpopular on both sides of the border that Nixon rolled it back 2 weeks after it began. But the effort sent a signal to federal, state, and local law enforcement, in customs and elsewhere, that marijuana was as serious a threat to U.S. interests as spies, revolutionary infiltrators, and enemy combatants. The sorts of threats that would normally move the government to such an extreme crackdown at the border. On October 3, 1969, 7 narcotics agents stormed apartments B and D at 8031 Comstock Avenue in Whittier, California, in a pre-dawn no-knock raid. 2 officers were from the California State Bureau of Narcotics. 4 were from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. And the last was Detective Sergeant Frank Sweeney, a police officer from the tiny nearby town of Vernon. In apartment B, 50-year-old Florence Mahan was asleep with her 12-year-old daughter, Susan. "I saw 3 men," Mahan told the Los Angeles Times. "One of them grabbed me by the arm. I screamed and I ran out. I thought they were going to attack me." Susan said, "They just grabbed Mommy and said they had a search warrant to look for marijuana." The officers had raided the wrong apartment. Their search warrant was for apartments B and D at 8033 Comstock Avenue. Those apartments were both on the second floor. Mian's other daughter, Linda, who was 23, lived on the second floor, though not in either of the targeted apartments, along with her husband, 22-year-old Hayward Dyer, and their 22-month-old son, Francis. Hayward Dyer awoke to the screaming and commotion from the mistaken raid in his mother-in-law's apartment, went downstairs to investigate, and was confronted by several police officer guns aimed in his direction. The narcotics team eventually realized that they had raided the wrong apartment. They immediately left to raid apartments B and D on the second floor. In the meantime, Linda Dyer, 7 months pregnant at the time, was also awakened by the noise. She went downstairs with Francis to check on her mother and sister. At some point, she handed the baby to her husband. As the police raided apartment B, Detective Sergeant Sweeney somehow mistakenly fired his .223 caliber rifle into the floor. The bullet ripped through the floor, then through the ceiling of the apartment below, where Hayward Dyer was standing holding his son. The bullet pierced Dyer's skull, killing him instantly. As his father fell, the infant Francis Dyer went crashing to the floor. From press accounts, the police never made clear why a police officer from Vernon went along for a raid in Whittier, and why he was carrying a rifle when neither the California Bureau of Narcotics, which directed the raid, nor the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department allowed it. Police agencies were, and still are, also supposed to notify any agency with overlapping jurisdiction during such raids, in part because local departments, especially in small towns, tend to have local knowledge. One example would have been knowing that this apartment complex had an odd way of assigning addresses. No such notification ever happened. The police did arrest one man in apartment D for possession of 2 red capsules and 2 white capsules, believed to be illegal narcotics, along with 150 marijuana seeds. By 1969, California was one of 25 states that had a no-knock law. Of course, Los Angeles County was also where Kerr versus California had originated, the case in which the U.S. Supreme Court 6 years earlier had, mostly, given its stamp of approval to the destroying evidence exception to the knock-and-announced rule, and William Brennan had warned of the consequences of such a dangerous precedent. Though Nixon wouldn't officially declare war on drugs until 1972, the modern drug war effectively began with his inauguration in 1969. It seems likely then that Hayward Dyer was the modern drug war's first innocent fatality. There would be more, many, many more. 5 years of unrest and increasingly militarized police actions culminated with America's very first SWAT raid in the final months of the 1960s. The December 1969 raid on the Los Angeles headquarters of the Black Panthers was also about as high-profile a debut for Daryl Gates' pet project as he could possibly have imagined. Practically, logistically, and tactically, the raid was an utter disaster. But in terms of public relations, it was an enormous success. The Black Panther Party hit its peak in 1969. Started in Oakland just 3 years earlier by Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, the activist group's mix of Marxism, militants, and black nationalism quickly found a following in the counterculture. Panthers often espoused their revolutionary rhetoric and illustrated their by-any-means-necessary motto by toting loaded rifles and handguns during public protests and demonstrations. It wasn't just talk. In a little over 3 years, 9 police officers and 10 Panthers had died in police-Panther confrontations across the country. By 1969, the group was 10,000 strong and had become a bright, blinking flashpoint on the radar of police in every city in which it had established a presence. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had made the Black Panthers a top priority and, naturally, had publicly declared war on them. There are conflicting accounts of the events that led up to the Panthers' SWAT raid. According to Gates' autobiography, sometime before the final confrontation, LAPD Captain Ted Morton received a complaint from a woman about noise coming from a loudspeaker in a building occupied by the Panthers. When Morton went in to investigate, he was greeted with several guns and warned to leave immediately. Morton returned to the police station and wrote up a report. And within a few days, Gates and the LAPD brass began drawing up plans to raid the building on charges of assaulting a police officer with a deadly weapon. Based on interviews with several Black Panthers who were in the building the morning of the raid, as well as with LAPD SWAT officer Patrick McKinley, journalist Matthew Fleischer offers a different narrative. On November 28, 1969, more than 250 police officers surrounded the Los Angeles Black Panther headquarters during a community meeting, sealing the facility off in what Panthers now call the test run. On December 4th, Fred Hampton, deputy chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panthers, was shot to death at point-blank range while he was sleeping during a raid by the Chicago Police Department. The incident drew international outrage. Back in L.A., there wasn't a Panther alive who didn't think a similar raid by the LAPD was coming their way. They were right. As it turns out, the night of the test run, police claimed to have seen 3 Panthers, Paul Redd, Duck Smith, and Geronimo Pratt, in possession of illegal firearms. The LAPD secured an arrest warrant for the 3, as well as a search warrant for the 41st and Central Headquarters, and 2 known Panther hideouts. By all accounts, the raid began at about 5:30 a.m. on December 6, 1969. The Black Panther building was well-armed and well-fortified. Gates and his SWAT team had put together blueprints of the building from intelligence they had collected from informants. Unfortunately, the blueprints critically misplaced a massive pile of dirt that the Panthers had built while digging out escape tunnels. The police had the dirt pile off in a corner. It was actually directly behind the back door, the same door through which the assault team was to make its surprise entry. When they tried to open the back door, the dirt pile prevented them from entering. They'd have to go through the front door. As they did, a helicopter swarmed overhead, and other officers began scaling the sides of the building. By plan, Gates's SWAT team was supposed to have made entry and secure the inside of the building by this point. Instead, a Panther lookout on the roof screamed, "They're here!" to his Confederates inside. By the time the SWAT team breached the front door, the Panthers were ready and greeted them with a storm of bullets. Three officers went down. Even worse, the SWAT team had entered an alcove with no escape except through the door they had just entered. Fortunately, the gunfire had started immediately, which let the officers know their cover had been blown. They dragged out their fallen colleagues and retreated. As Fleischer puts it, "If the Panthers had held their fire for a few moments more, the entire SWAT team would have made it into the alcove and been shot to pieces." Over the next 3 hours, L.A. police and the Black Panthers exchanged over 5,000 rounds in a crowded city setting. The entire neighborhood was evacuated, and the surrounding streets were shut down just before the morning rush hour. Los Angeles Police Chief Ed Davis was in Mexico at the time, making Gates the acting chief. After a couple hours of gunfire, Gates and his SWAT officers came up with a new idea. They would use a grenade launcher on the building. Gates contacted the Marines at Camp Pendleton. He was told that, at the very least, he'd need permission from the Department of Defense. He'd probably also need it from the President. Gates writes in his book, "I called Mayor Sam Yorty next and asked if he would make the call to Washington. My words seemed unreal. Anytime you even talk about using military equipment in a civil action, it's very serious business. You're bridging an enormous gap." Yorty agreed, and within an hour, the Department of Defense gave Gates permission to use a grenade launcher on the Panthers building. It's a remarkable anecdote, not because Gates sought permission to use the weapon, or even because the Pentagon gave it to him. Given the circumstances, it may not even have been all that unreasonable a request. The story is remarkable because of the procedures, the caution, and the trepidation that went into procuring the grenade launcher. About 20 years later, the Pentagon would begin giving away millions of pieces of military equipment to police departments across the country for everyday use, including plenty of grenade launchers. The accounts of the raid again differ about how it ended, but after hours of gunfire, the Panthers finally waved a white flag to surrender. In the end, four Black Panthers and four LAPD officers were wounded. Somehow no one was killed. Six Panthers were arrested, booked, charged, and jailed. If the objective of the SWAT team was to serve the warrants and make the arrests with no fatalities, then the raid was a success. But of course it was far from that. The SWAT officer McKinley summed up the raid to Fleischer. "Oh God, we were lucky. I'm extremely proud of what we did that day. We got our targets and no one died, but oh God, we were lucky." Gates's surprise tactics had one unexpectedly deleterious effect. They gave the Panthers a plausible argument of self-defense. The Panthers awoke to men with guns breaking down their door and firing bullets into the walls. Paramilitary police tactics were new at the time, and the mixed-race jury apparently found them pretty alarming. All six Panthers were acquitted of the most serious charges, including conspiracy to murder police officers. That again is a stark illustration of how much standards and expectations have changed since then. It's nearly unthinkable that a self-defense claim under similar circumstances would be successful today. Indeed, several subjects of these sorts of raids have made that argument, and they almost always have failed. Though it was only by sheer luck that the bumbling raid wasn't a bloody disaster, and the tactics themselves ultimately contributed to acquittals of the very dangerous suspects the entire operation was designed to put in prison. The country's maiden high-profile SWAT raid was also a massive, uncompromising show of force against an organization that was widely feared and despised by politicians, law enforcement officials, and most Americans whose politics fell outside the far left. Activists and editorial boards raged, but the Black Panther raid was a public relations triumph. Within 5 years, the Panthers would splinter, fizzle, and, for the most part, evaporate. SWAT would grow, spread to other cities, and become a pop culture phenomenon. By the time Gates died in 2010, the institution he started had spread to nearly every city in the country, to most federal agencies, to most medium-sized towns, and even to small and tiny towns. The wisdom of limiting SWAT assaults to genuine emergencies was long gone. Across the country, the tactics Gates had conceived to stop snipers and rioters, people already committing violent crimes, had come to be used primarily to serve warrants on people suspected of nonviolent crimes. The numbers. Percentage of Americans who thought the Supreme Court was too soft on criminals in 1965, 48%. In 1968, 63%. In 1969, 75%. Percentage of Americans in 1968 who disapproved of interracial marriage, 75%. Percentage of Americans who supported the Chicago police after the 1968 Democratic National Convention riots, 56%. Of Nixon supporters, 63%. Of Wallace supporters, 71%. Of Humphrey supporters, 44%. Percentage of Americans who supported the death penalty in 1966, 42%. Percentage who supported the death penalty in 1969, 51%. Percentage of parents who, in 1969, said they would turn in their own kid for using drugs, 42%. Chapter 5. The 1970s. Pinch and retreat. Drug people are the very vermin of humanity. They are dangerous. Occasionally, we must adopt their dress and tactics. Miles Ambrose, head of Nixon's Office of Drug Abuse and Law Enforcement. Sam Ervin was an unlikely civil liberties hero, known for his bushy, high-arching eyebrows. The avuncular senator from Morgantown, North Carolina, was the prototype backwoods bumpkin who passed himself off as just a simple country lawyer right before unleashing the devastating argument that crushed his opponents and won the day. In a thick, jowly drawl, he'd dispense folksy anecdotes, Bible verses, and righteous indignation, and in the next breath, drop quotes from Shakespeare, Aristotle, Kipling, or Thomas Wolfe. Born in 1896, Ervin was a decorated World War I veteran who earned a Silver Star, 2 Purple Hearts, and a Distinguished Service Cross during his commission as an infantryman in France. When he returned home, the whip-smart veteran quickly ascended the ranks of North Carolina politics. When Democratic Senator Clyde Hoyt died in 1954, Ervin was sitting on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Governor William Umstead asked him to fill the vacant seat, and he accepted. Sam Ervin would remain a U.S. Senator for 20 years. What many would come to see as contradictions or surprises in Ervin as a public figure were, in fact, his way of balancing a collection of values drawn from his faith, his constitution, his heritage, the mores and traditions of his region, and his scholarship. Though a deeply religious man, for example, Ervin successfully led an effort in the North Carolina legislature to defeat a law that would have prohibited teaching evolution in the state's schools. Ervin found the law embarrassing. Though Ervin was a Democrat, he and Nixon were often on the same side of the 1960s culture wars. Ervin largely supported Nixon's efforts in Vietnam. He also opposed Brown v. Board of Education, though he'd later change his mind, and the 1964 Civil Rights Act. He was a signatory of the Southern Manifesto, which accused the U.S. Supreme Court of overstepping its authority on integration and breaching state sovereignty. Irvin even reversed course on integration at about the time the Nixon administration made desegregating public schools a Justice Department priority. Indeed, by the time Nixon ran for president in 1968, Irvin appeared to be precisely the sort of God and country, law and order, Southern Democrat Nixon was hoping to court with his campaign. The two also shared a contempt for the Warren Court. In the 1957 case Mallory v. United States, the court ruled as inadmissible the confession of a subject who had been interrogated for 7 hours before he was notified of his rights or given a preliminary hearing. In response, Irvin took to the floor of the U.S. Senate to defend the integrity of law enforcement officers. Irvin complained that the courts had perversely decided that criminals need protection from law enforcement more than society needs protection from criminals. It was a speech that Nixon himself might have given on the campaign trail 10 years later. The Nixonites, then, would be struck dumb when Sam Irvin emerged in the early 1970s, not only as Nixon's most formidable Watergate nemesis on Capitol Hill, but also as the angriest, loudest, and most powerful critic of Nixon's crime policy. Even more surprising, he would beat them. Thanks to Irvin, the Castle Doctrine stayed afloat for about another decade before being submerged by the 1980s war on drugs. Attorney General John Mitchell and his subordinates began their big legislative crime push in the summer of 1969. They found plenty of willing help on Capitol Hill. In both chambers, Nixon administration allies and crime hawks introduced a flurry of bills containing sweeping new provisions. When Stanford law professor and criminologist Herbert Packer asked the Justice Department just how many crime bills there were, one official replied in a letter, "I leave it to you to make the count." In an October 1970 essay for the New York Review of Books, he tried. Packer counted 12 bills that came directly from the White House plan, and 8 more introduced independently that the White House supported. Packer counted at least 4 Senate and 5 House committees claiming jurisdiction over some version of a crime bill, and that wasn't counting the Appropriations Committee in each chamber. And because the two bodies wouldn't pass identical versions of any bill, there would also be a slew of conference committees to sort out all the differences. It seems unlikely that all of this overlapping legislative activity was planned, but it had the benefit of making any organized opposition to the bills rather difficult. The no-knock raid came up in 2 bills. The first was the Omnibus Crime Control Act, which authorized no-knock raids, preventive detention, expanded wiretapping, night raids, and other powers in federal investigations. That bill was also split up. The portion including preventive detention hit the House Judiciary Committee in October 1969, while another version headed to the same committee in the Senate, chaired by Irvin. When the bill hit Irvin's desk, he couldn't believe what he saw. The senator fired an early shot across the president's bow when he called the preventive detention proposals facile and desperate and tyrannical, and added that the very idea of eliminating bail repudiates our traditional concept of liberty. The Nixon administration was gobsmacked. Irvin had supported the Republicans' election year crime package just a year earlier. He was an influential voice in the Senate, especially given his position on the Judiciary Committee. They were counting on his support, and he had just lashed out at the centerpiece of their crime strategy. The White House regrouped and decided instead to put its initial push behind the crime bill aimed specifically at Washington, D.C. No-knock raids were in that bill, as was preventive detention. The bill also eliminated probation and suspended sentences for some crimes, imposed mandatory life sentences for others, and broadly expanded wiretapping authority. The bill allowed police to conduct on-the-spot urinalysis tests during drug raids, allowed them to seize anything they found in a raid, they had been limited to seizing only the items they had listed in the search warrant affidavit, and removed the restriction requiring police to be certain that the evidence they were looking for would be found before they could raid a home at night. Since Nixon and Mitchell were most interested in quickly accumulating legislative victories on the law and order issues that had won them election, the major advantage of the D.C. bill was that, at least early in the process, it could be routed around the unexpected obstacle of Sam Ervin and his Judiciary Committee. Instead, the Washington bill began at the House and Senate committees that oversaw the District of Columbia. In the House, that committee was chaired by Representative John McMillan, a good old boy conservative Southern Democrat who had once sent a truckload of watermelons to the black mayor of Washington, D.C. He'd be an ally. In the Senate, the D.C. Oversight Committee was chaired by Senator Joe Tidings, a Democrat from Maryland. Though Tidings was one of the more liberal members of the Senate, he faced a tough re-election in 1970. Maryland was home to a large, white, wealthy batch of D.C. suburbs, and many of those suburbanites worked in Washington. If they hadn't been mugged themselves, they probably knew someone who had. At the very least, they had read the press accounts of the city's crime problem. The tougher on crime Joe Tidings could look, the better his prospects for re-election. Tidings's committee reported out a crime package of more than 300 pages. It included court reorganization, no-knock raids and preventive detention, allowing raiding cops to administer on-the-spot urine tests, tougher sentencing guidelines, and an absurd proposal to let prosecutors appeal acquittals. When Ervin learned of those provisions, he demanded they be removed, or he'd mount an effort to kill the bill entirely. Most of them were taken out, or at least they were narrowed. Preventive detention was removed entirely and reintroduced as a separate bill. The no-knock provision stayed in, but was slightly altered to require police to show a substantial probability that evidence would be destroyed if they were to make themselves known before forcing entry. The change was mostly cosmetic, but at least appeared to make the no-knock warrant more difficult to obtain. In December 1969, the package easily passed the full Senate. Perhaps because the idea still wasn't largely understood outside members of the Nixon administration and a few state legislators and Rockefeller administration officials in New York, there was little objection to the no-knock provision, even from Ervin. But the minor change to the bill's language would later become very important. On the House side, Representative McMillan was working on a D.C. bill more in line with what Nixon and Mitchell wanted than what had come out of the Senate. McMillan's hearings on the House bill lasted less than an hour, and only members of the Nixon administration were permitted to testify. When Ervin heard about the House bill, which included everything he'd fought in the Senate bill and worse, he was outraged. He called it a garbage pail of some of the most repressive, nearsighted, intolerant, unfair, and vindictive policies he had ever encountered in politics. The bill swept through McMillan's committee and was approved by the full House. It would be up to a conference committee to decide which vision of crime control would be imposed on Washington, D.C. The Senate reconvened after the new year for a blitz of important votes. In the chaos of the great crime bill orgy of 1970, many senators would vote on bills that took predatory swipes at civil liberties protections dating back centuries, with little knowledge of what was actually in them. Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, the highest-ranking member of the Senate after the vice president, was typical. Mansfield said at one point that he was so overwhelmed he'd just given up on trying to figure out if some of the laws he was voting on were constitutional. He said he'd just vote for them all and let the courts sort it out. The Omnibus Narcotics Bill, in particular, represented a massive shift of power to the Justice Department. The bill was sponsored by Democratic Senator Thomas J. Dodd of Connecticut, father of the future U.S. Senator Christopher Dodd. For Nixon, Dodd was a useful Confederate. That he was a Democrat from New England helped with building coalitions. He was also a former federal prosecutor who had participated in the Nazi trials at Nuremberg, and he had chaired subcommittee hearings on LSD that led to federal prohibition of the drug. Although Dodd had plenty of anti-crime credibility, the senator's personal commitment to law and order was less than impeccable. 3 years earlier, he had been censured by the Senate for diverting campaign funds to his personal bank account. But that was all the more reason for him to cast his lot with the crime hawks. Also up for re-election in 1970, Dodd needed an issue to make his constituents forget about his personal peccadilloes. He probably thought he'd found it with crime and drugs. Since the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1913, the federal government's authority to regulate illicit drugs had mostly been limited to the power to tax them. But in 1969, the Supreme Court struck down the Marijuana Tax Act in a case involving the counterculture icon Timothy Leary. Dodd's bill took a new strategy. Instead of trying to prohibit illicit drugs by taxing them, Dodd's bill gave the Justice Department a wide range of new powers to directly enforce federal drug prohibition under the authority of the Constitution's Commerce Clause. There was a cruel historical irony at work here. The Commerce Clause gives Congress the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. The founders intended the power to be used only in a very narrow set of circumstances, such as when one state attempts to favor its own businesses or citizens over those of the other states. Over the years, the Supreme Court had forged a much broader interpretation, that the Commerce Clause gives Congress the authority to regulate any activity that affects commerce in more than one state. Roosevelt's New Deal-era justices were especially fond of the interpretation, perhaps most famously in the 1942 case Wickard versus Filburn, in which the court ruled that the Commerce Clause gives Congress the authority to impose quotas on the amount of wheat a farmer can grow on his own land, even if he's only growing the wheat for his own use. The court's rationale was that the wheat the farmer grows for himself is wheat he isn't purchasing on the market, thus affecting interstate commerce. In 1964, Congress drew on that interpretation of the Commerce Clause to pass the Civil Rights Act, which gives the federal government broad powers to target private businesses that engage in racial discrimination. When those powers were challenged, the Warren Court continued to broaden the Commerce Clause in support of the law, ruling, for example, that Congress has the authority to forcibly integrate any businesses along major highways and interstates, or any businesses that sell products made in other states. But the same broad interpretation of the Commerce Clause that allowed the federal government to integrate private businesses in the South also gave Mitchell and Nixon the authority to wage their war on crime and drugs, a war that, over the next 40 years, had some devastating consequences for large swaths of black America. In the omnibus law, Mitchell would claim for his department all authority to oversee the manufacture, distribution, export, import, and sale of addictive drugs. The bill created a classification system for illicit drugs and vested the classification authority with the Justice Department. That met with fierce resistance from researchers and medical organizations who believed that authority to determine which psychoactive drugs have medical benefits and which cause harm should belong to the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, or to an agency like the FDA, instead of an agency whose primary mission was law enforcement. Their pleas were in vain. A version of the Dodd bill would later become the Controlled Substances Act, the law that has authorized the war on drugs ever since. It isn't clear why Irvin didn't put up more of a fight against the no-knock raid back in December 1969 with the D.C. crime bill. Perhaps he simply hadn't had time to read it or consider its consequences. By the time the omnibus drug bill came to his committee, he attempted to remove the no-knock provision, but failed to muster enough support. But on January 25, 1970, the omnibus bill came to the floor of the full Senate. This time, Irvin was ready. He forced the Senate to debate no-knock raids for 3 days. Irvin was the loudest, most indignant of the policy's opponents. He declared the tactic incompatible with the essence of liberty and proclaimed, "I stand on the proposition that every man's home is his castle, and that the Congress should not go on record as allowing Department of Justice officials to break into a home like burglars." Invoking the British common law cases, he steamed that the tactic was not using the keys of the king to open all the doors, but instead using the king's axe to knock down the door and break the window. For a while, it looked as if Irvin might have had enough support to strip the measure from the larger bill. After the first day of debate, even Senator Dodd, the bill's sponsor, had reservations. Dodd told the New York Times that the no-knock raid was one of the toughest questions I've faced, and that he was now almost of an open mind about it. But Dodd toughened his resolve, and the no-knock supporters fought back. Dodd forebodingly warned his fellow senators that the hoodlums are watching us, the dope peddlers are watching us. They want to know if we mean what we say. Republican Senator Robert Griffin of Michigan argued that the no-knock raid was no big deal because 29 states had already legalized it. In truth, only a handful of state legislators had explicitly legalized the tactic. In most cases, it was simply that a state appellate court had at some point in the state's history refused to throw out evidence obtained in a raid in which police didn't knock and announce themselves. That was quite different from what the Senate was considering, explicitly authorizing federal agents to use the no-knock raid as a get-tough-on-criminals tactic. The Senate's two-party leaders also lined up against Irvin. Republican Minority Leader Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania lamented, "We are encountering a certain amount of sob-sisterism from people who tend to weep somewhat excessively about the rights of the drug pusher." Given that the measure's chief opponent was Irvin, the fierce critic of the Warren Court who supported the Republicans' crime bill in 1968, the charge was rubbish. Majority Leader Mansfield, meanwhile, returned to his argument of shifting responsibility. He urged the senators to simply put their trust in the courts to properly oversee no-knock warrants. Still, Irvin had the momentum, and a growing faction of senators were lining up behind him. By January 27th, the Times reported, Senate leaders were predicting that Senator Irvin would win his fight. But then, Senator Griffin pulled off a brilliant bit of legislative maneuvering. He introduced an amendment changing a single word in the no-knock provision. In the original wording, police could enter without knocking if they could show that evidence may be destroyed. Griffin changed the phrase to will be destroyed. Technically, that was supposed to make it more difficult to obtain a no-knock warrant. In practice, it made no difference at all. It was a standard that had no real definition, and in any case, in the event that a police officer did hypothetically exaggerate the threat of a suspect destroying evidence to get a no-knock, the mere fact that it was a no-knock raid meant that it was a standard that could never be verified after the fact. But it was still a shrewd bit of politicking. Even senators who opposed the no-knock raid in general might vote for an amendment restricting its use, just in case the law itself was passed, and several did. Griffin's amendment passed 44-40. Griffin then revealed his trickery. Once his amendment had passed, he pointed out that the no-knock law in this bill was now identical to the bill the Senate had passed for D.C. just a month earlier. That one had slipped through without much debate. Any senator voting against this bill would then have to explain why he voted to allow no-knock raids in D.C., but was now against allowing federal agents to use the tactic in the rest of the country. On January 28th, the no-knock provision passed, 70-15. But there was nothing to fear, Dodd promised. Federal agents would use the new tactic in the most discriminating manner possible. The purpose of a conference committee is to hash out the differences between the versions of similar bills that emerge from the House and Senate. In theory, these committees are made up of the politicians who shaped the bill in each chamber and are expected to put up a fight for the version of the bill authored by their committee. That didn't happen with the D.C. crime bill when the House-Senate Conference Committee began work on it in the spring of 1970. The House version was much tougher than the Senate version, and Senator Tidings completely capitulated on no-knock, preventive detention, and most of the other controversial provisions, sometimes over the objections of four members of his own committee, two of whom were Republicans. In the end, the Senate conferees voted for the House bill and what Irvin called its garbage pail of police powers, 5-3. The full compromise bill would return to the full House and Senate one last time before being sent to Nixon for his signature. Meanwhile, the citizens of D.C. began to learn about what was in this bill about to be imposed on their city. They wanted no part of it. D.C. Mayor Walter Washington spoke out publicly against the no-knock and preventive detention measures. A city attorney told the New York Times that no one in the city's government had been consulted while the bill was being drafted. It was all done by Nixon aides. In late May, a group of black civic and religious leaders, including Democratic National Committee Chairman Channing Phillips and future Mayor Marion Barry, spoke out against the bill. Incredibly, they told citizens of D.C. that if they caught police breaking into their homes under the new law, they should resist by appropriate action. What did that mean? One of the community leaders, Julius Hobson, a co-founder of the D.C. Statehood Party, suggested greeting the raiding cops with a shotgun. "I would shoot him down in cold blood, just like I would swat a fly," he said. Three other black leaders, all clergy, agreed with him. They weren't alone in that sentiment. During the House debate on the bill, Representative Bertram Podell, a white Democrat from Brooklyn, said that he too would shoot any police officer who tried to enter his home unannounced. But such objections were up against soaring crime in the city. The figures from 1969 in particular were grim. There were 287 murders that year, up from 195 the previous year, and just 82 in 1962. Robberies were up 50% from 1968, and rapes, incredibly, jumped more than 300%. The media piled on. In March 1970, the New York Times ran a long, sensational article about crime in D.C. The lead photo showed a woman walking in the dark in front of a notable D.C. landmark. Embedded in the photo was a drop quote: "You must be out of your mind to be out alone after dark in a neighborhood like this." The caption under the photo read, "The warning quote above was spoken by a passerby to a woman in Washington. She looked up, and there was the White House." The article also borrowed some of Nixon's war rhetoric. In discussing how some blacks in D.C. had become distrustful of police, author James Batten, who would later become chairman of Knight Ridder, wrote, "In the slums of Washington, as in the hamlets of South Vietnam, if the natives wish to protect fugitives from the authorities, they usually can succeed." As it turned out, crime in D.C. peaked before the new crime bills had even passed. By May 1970, crime in the city had fallen for five straight months. At that point, the only Nixon policies that had been implemented in D.C. were a federally funded methadone program and some funding for additional police officers. The methadone program in particular appeared to be working. But the Nixonites had little interest in taking credit for a treatment program. As Nixon aide Edgell Krogh put it to top Nixon advisor John Ehrlichman, "All the liberals need is an argument that if the picture is improving with just the addition of more police and a new narcotics treatment agency, there is no need for the repressive Nixon crime proposals." That sentiment won the day. The Justice Department withheld the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, data showing improved crime statistics for D.C. until after Nixon signed the D.C. crime bill into law. The administration then released the numbers and took credit for them. But the Nixonites also continued to keep the results from the methadone program close to the vest. But while perception of soaring crime in D.C. continued to attract support for the crime bill as a whole, the no-knock raid was finally starting to get some attention in the media. New York Times columnist Tom Wicker and syndicated columnist Art Buchwald wrote in opposition to it. The Washington Post editorialized that the policy treated the city like a penal colony and that it ought to be opposed by every action appropriate to men who believe in the rule of law. Even conservative Prince William F. Buckley Jr. acknowledged the potential for abuse, although he ultimately came down in favor of it. Civil libertarians by then generally agreed that Clark's opinion in Kerr was accepted law, and that Nixon's no-knock proposal didn't go any further than that. So they were left to oppose the bill on policy grounds. My honest feeling is that it's probably constitutional, ACLU General Counsel Norman Dorson told the New York Times. but there's a grave question about the policy behind it. Santarelli says the most convincing argument for the law was that it merely brought oversight to something that was already happening. We found out that many police officers had been conducting no-knock raids anyway. Then they'd get to court and explain why the exigent circumstances at the scene allowed them to break in without an announcement. So we were letting police make the subjective decision on site about whether exigent circumstances existed. The no-knock law required someone other than police to make the call about exigent circumstances ahead of time. It brought in judicial scrutiny, or at least it was supposed to. But police could still make a decision at the scene to enter without announcing. At worst, a judge might later suppress the evidence. And even that was rare, because it was easy to fake exigent circumstances. A D.C. judge would later cynically call the no-knock law an anti-perjury bill, explaining that it excuses the officials from saying they knocked when they hadn't. The administration might have had an inkling that the tide was turning. In testimony before a House committee in July, at the same time the Senate was again debating the tactic, Mitchell said that without no-knock authority, drug agents would die and clever and ruthless drug peddlers could destroy evidence and go free. But what he did next was far more interesting. Mitchell insisted that the very phrase no-knock raid was a catchword used by people who coddled criminals. Mitchell blamed erroneous citizens and newsmen for using such sensationalist language. He then asked the committee to start calling the tactic quick entry, which he said would be less misleading and prejudicial. This was nonsense. Nixonians themselves had been using the term since his campaign kicked into gear in 1967. More to the point, tough-sounding, no-mercy rhetoric had always been part of their anti-crime strategy. They had wanted the media, civil libertarians, and liberals to characterize Nixon's crime policies in the most draconian terms possible. The most likely reason Mitchell abandoned that strategy was that the White House sensed that no-knock wasn't playing well with Nixon's ignored Americans. Until then, tough-on-crime, law-and-order rhetoric had been a winner. Most ignored Americans didn't think of themselves as criminals, and so could never picture themselves in need of a Miranda warning, an empathetic judge, or the advantages of preparing a defense from outside of a jail cell. But the ignored Americans had homes. Many were gun owners. And as a demographic group, they were likely to revere the Castle Doctrine. No polling data on no-knock existed at the time, but it seems at least possible that the increased media coverage of the issue caused even staunch crime fighters to see the possible negative consequences to allowing drug cops to go crashing into homes. Whatever Mitchell may have wanted to accomplish for no-knock by changing its name, for all practical purposes, the political debate over no-knock raids in D.C. was over. Mitchell and Nixon had won. When Tidings made no effort to cut or water down the provision while the bill was in conference committee, it was irrevocably attached to the D.C. crime bill. Since the House and Senate had to vote on the conference committee bill as a whole, no changes or amendments are permitted in conference committee bills. Otherwise, the legislative process would drag on forever. The only way Irvin and his allies could defeat no-knock was to defeat the entire D.C. crime bill. Circumstances at the time made that an impossible task. Because Mitchell was sitting on the D.C. crime figures, there was still the perception that crime was rising in the city. The midterm elections were also just a few months away. Even senators who strongly agreed with Irvin about no-knock or preventive detention weren't ready to sacrifice the entire bill to prevent those policies from passing. Members of the House and Senate who needed to look tough on crime had an incentive to stay and record a vote in favor of the bill. Those who didn't went home to campaign or just to take a vacation. The long odds didn't faze Irvin. He'd lost on no-knock the first time because too few of the supporters he'd lined up on the Judiciary Committee bothered to show up to vote against it. He'd lost the second time because of a slick parliamentary maneuver. And he'd lose this time because it wasn't possible to vote against the no-knock measure without also voting against the entire crime bill. but he'd sure as hell put up a fight. On July 17, 1970, Irvin took the floor and spoke extemporaneously against the bill for 4.5 hours. Over the course of an impassioned diatribe on the floor of the Senate, he protested, "Mr. President, the supreme value of civilization is the freedom of the individual, which is simply the right of the individual to be free from government tyranny." He pleaded with his fellow senators not to enact a bill that contained provisions that were so hostile to the traditions that had prevailed in the United States ever since it became a republic. "Once gone," he cautioned, "the liberties that the bill threatened would be gone forever." There was some poignant symbolism in Irvin's sustained philippic. This was a man who, over the course of his career, had signed the Southern Manifesto, railed against Brown v. Board of Education, excoriated the Warren Court, and publicly lamented the criminal coddling ways of the Johnson administration. Here was a law that, at root, was part of a mass backlash against the Warren Court, that tapped into public anger over the government being too soft on criminals, and that would primarily and overwhelmingly be utilized against black residents of the District of Columbia. And here was Sam Irvin, standing on the floor of the Senate, passionately orating against it, using notes quickly scribbled on the backs of envelopes to sling obloquy and reproach at the bill's supporters. Liberals like Todd and Tidings had sold out D.C. to get reelected. For black folks in the District of Columbia, the biggest, loudest, most potent force keeping the cops from crashing through their doors was Sam Irvin, the country lawyer, folksy Bible thumper, and only recently reformed segregationist. But the bill passed easily. Nixon signed the D.C. crime bill into law on July 29th. A few months later, Irvin put up yet another fight when the no-knock raid omnibus drug bill for the entire country came before the Senate in October. He lost that one too, 42-20. More than a third of the Senate didn't stick around to vote. In his autobiography, Irvin writes that he warned his colleagues that the no-knock measures would be grossly abused by complacent magistrates and overzealous officers, and that in consequence, both householders and officers would suffer death, and humble, law-abiding people would be unnecessarily harassed by no-knock raids upon their homes. The next 4 years would prove him right, and after a brief period of sanity, so would the next 30. I started to become more and more concerned about potential abuses with the no-knock raid, says Don Santarelli. By 1971, he had been appointed director of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, the federal agency that doled out grants and gear to police agencies. But it was more than just the no-knock raids. Some of the police chiefs he worked with, he noticed, had an increasingly gung-ho mentality. Under the 1970 federal crime bill, the annual budget for Santarelli's agency jumped from $75 million to $500 million. It seemed like every police department in the country wanted a piece. That wasn't so unusual. But it was what they wanted that Santarelli found concerning. They didn't value education or training. They valued hardware, he says. The city of Birmingham asked him for an armored personnel carrier, APC. Other chiefs wanted tanks. Los Angeles asked him for a submarine. Anything the police chiefs could dream up to make themselves look more fearsome, they wanted, Santarelli says. They were also requesting the gear and military training to start their own tactical teams, like the one quickly becoming famous in Los Angeles. I was always hesitant about that. There were certain supervised, tightly controlled circumstances where that kind of force was appropriate, but law enforcement has never been good at self-discipline. Once they had that sort of capability, it would be difficult to limit it to those circumstances, Santarelli says. In Detroit, for example, a new police commissioner took over in 1971 and began implementing a more Nixonian approach to illicit drugs. Chief John Nichols doubled up the personnel on his narcotics unit and started arresting and imprisoning heroin dealers instead of merely chasing them off, as the city had done in the past. The result was an impressive stat sheet on the enforcement side. 1,600 arrests. But cracking down on dealers opened the city up to turf wars. In one 10-day stretch in June, Detroit logged 40 murders. It was one of the first examples of the sort of self-perpetuating,